So this winter's retreat, I've emphasized this trying to bring this feeling for right understanding, samadhi, because it's an intuitive understanding. It's not a conceptual one. I found it very helpful in just, you know, like contemplating the difference between thinking, analytical thinking, and intuitive awareness, just to make it clear, you know, what that is, because the difference between the use of the mind to think, analyze, reason, criticize, to hold, to, you know, have ideas, perceptions, views and opinions, to the intuitive awareness, which is non-critical. It includes criticism. It's an inclusive awareness. So it's not like criticism isn't allowed in it, but criticism is included. The critical mind is seen as an object. Your tendency to criticize or compare, to hold one view, say this is better than that, or this is right, that's wrong. Criticism of yourself or others or whatever, even though criticisms can be justified and valid on that level, we're not interested on that in just developing our critical faculties, because they're usually in countries like this highly developed already. But to develop, to trust in the intuitive awareness. So like where sati sampajanya come to life, and I use satipanya a lot before panya, but then sampajanya is a word that, you know, say I translated into English as clear comprehension, which is so vague and kind of, you know, even though it says clear, it doesn't give you a sense of the broadness of that clarity. You know, when you have clearly defined, when you have clear definitions of everything, then you think you have clear comprehension. So that's why we don't like confusion, isn't it? We don't like to feel foggy or confused or uncertain. These kind of states we really dislike, and, you know, spend a lot of time trying to have clear comprehension or certainty. So, but then sampajanya includes fogginess, includes confusion, includes uncertainty, insecurity. So it's a clear comprehension or the apperception of, say, of confusion is like this, uncertainty, insecurity is like this. So it's a clear comprehension or apprehension of even the most vague or amorphous or nebulous mental conditions. So then it's this, you know, like some people, you know, find this approach frustrating because it's easier to be told exactly what to do, you know, to have a more methodic approach. But many of us have done that, and even though it has can be very skillful. It also can be kind of addictive, like we never get to the root of the cause, which is, you know, I am this person that needs this and in order to become enlightened. So this intuitive approach doesn't exclude methodical meditations. You know, it's not like I'm against, the methods of meditation or that exist in our tradition, Theravada Buddhism. Not at all. But even trying to put that into perspective, so that if you do, you know, go to these different meditation retreats or courses or whatever, then, you know, you're not, you know, basic. I'm hoping that what you've contemplated during this winter is will have some, you know, help you to be able to do the method in a much more skillful way than if you just start from just faith in a method and never questioning, never seeing beyond the ignorant perceptions of yourself. You know, if you start from the ignorant perceptions of yourself as your basis. You know, so this winter retreat has been to encourage you to really question, to really look into these perceptions you have of yourself. You know, whatever they might be, if you think you're the best, greatest God's gift to the world, or you think you're the absolute bottom of the stack, or you don't know who you are, what you want, or sometimes you think you're superior, sometimes you feel inferior, whatever, because these things change. The personality view, Sakaya Ditti, Silabhata Paramartha, Vichikicca, as the first three fetters that hide the path, that keep us from seeing the way of non-suffering. Like trying to figure out how to be aware, isn't it? It's an impossible task. You know, what is he talking about anyway? Wake up, be aware, and then trying to figure it out and think about it. You just go around in circles. It's a frustrating intuitive awareness. It's frustrating to an analytical person whose faith is in thought and reason, logic. So awareness then isn't a matter of, you know, it's right now, so it's not a matter of thinking about it, but being aware of thinking about it. How do you do that? It's like my insight came when I was a samanera. How do you stop thinking? And then stop thinking. Well, how do you stop? Just stop. How do you just stop? the mind would always come back with, you know, how? How can you do it? Wanting to figure it out rather than trusting in the imminent imminence of it. And then trusting is relaxing into it, and just the attentiveness in which it's an act of faith, it's a trustingness, it's sadha. Like with it, then it gives you perspective on anything you want to do, whether it's meditation or yoga or tai chi or any or mahasi, sayadaw type meditations or goenkaji or any of these different teachers or different methods, or even different, you know, like the training the physical body with these various mindful practices, yoga and tai chi, things like that. Qigong can, you know, really are, you know, fit well into an intuitive approach, actually, ultimately, when we develop those techniques, it ends up as one has to trust in the mindfulness rather than in just me, my willful efforts trying to do all these things. Remember when I started yoga years ago, Hatha Yoga, just see these pictures of yogis doing all these fantastic postures. I wanted to do them, the really impressive ones, because I had a big ego and wanted to, didn't want to be the boring kind of things that you start out with. But, you know, really aiming at the fantastic. Of course, you've kind of damaged yourself trying to make your body do what you want before it's ready to. It's pretty dangerous. So intuition is also knowing the limits of your own body, what it can take, and it's not just willfully making it do this and do that according to your ideals or ideas of what you want it to do, because you can really, as many of you know, damage your body quite badly through just a kind of tyrannical forcing it to do something. So it's learning, you know, mindfulness includes the body, sati sampajanya. So it's willing to, and includes its limitation, its disabilities, its sicknesses, as well as its health and its pleasures. So another thing is pleasure, because we can think of in Theravada Buddhism, where physical sensual pleasure is, we can easily see it in terms of something we shouldn't enjoy, and being celibate and obs mendicants, then there's this, the Western mind especially easily sees it in terms of denying pleasure, happiness and joy. Like you say, all is suffering. We do the asupa practices, we say the body is foul, loathsome, filled with excrement, pus and slime and things like that. And so then you shouldn't even, you know, look at, if you're a monk, you should never look at a woman and keep your eyes down, and you shouldn't, indulge in the pleasures of beauty of anything. So I remember even in Thailand, I was getting this, you shouldn't even look at a flower because its beauty would capture me and make me think of worldly thoughts, you know. Because I'm from a kind of background, Christian background, that has a strong kind of puritanical ethic to it. So it's easy for someone like me, from a culture like mine, to assume that pleasure, sense pleasure is bad, and it's dangerous, you've got to try to deny it and avoid it at all costs. But then that's another opinion and view that comes out of the analytical mind, isn't it? From my cultural background, the logic, you see, the foulness or the loathsomeness of the body, asupa practice, is easy for me to see it in terms of being repelled and seeing the body in terms of something absolutely disgusting. And it's easy to see, I can convince myself of this, bodily functions, and also, you know, to see, you know, you sometimes you even look at yourself even when you're fairly healthy and you feel disgusted. At least I can. So that it's not it's a kind of natural way to feel about yourself if you're identified with the body and you dwell on its less appealing aspects. But in the word asupa is not, this, you know, it's loathsome isn't a very good word, because to me loathsome means it's really just really repelled and averse. If something's loathsome, it's dirty and foul and you just develop aversion. You just want to get rid of it. It's bad and nasty. So, but asupa doesn't have that. It means the non-beautiful. Supa is beautiful. Asupa is non-beautiful. Now that puts it in a better context, you know, of looking at what is not beautiful and noticing it. Because we don't, you know, we don't notice. We tend to give our attention to the beautiful, say, in the worldly life. And then the non-beautiful we either ignore or we reject. Or we don't pay any attention to it. We just dismiss it if it's just not very attractive or non-beautiful. So the vowel a in asupa is a negation, like amaravati, the deathless. Mara is death, amara is deathless. I found that a better way of looking at a supa practice, and not looking at the. Remember, in the old days, Kanti Paolo Bhikkhu, in not the German one, but the English one that disrobed, he wrote this book called Bag of Bones, and published in Buddhist Society publication. It's the most disgusting book I've ever read. It is just so foul, and then he seemed to enjoy it. Like when you talk to him, you see the eye dirt and the ear dirt, and he got kind of glee almost. You know, he got a perverted kind of joy out of contemplating the foul excretions of one's body, and it almost a creepy feeling. You know, this I don't think this is a supa. More like pornography. Like any of you that have seen autopsies and that, you know, it's, I find these, you know, not leading to like a depression or aversion, you know, contemplating a dead human body and when they're cutting it up in an autopsy. You know, at first it's shocking. You feel shocked because it's, you know, something that you, if you've never seen it, it can be pretty shocking. And the smells and the appearance can be, you can feel averse to it at first. But if you stay beyond that, if you can, you know, stay beyond just the initial reaction of shock or aversion, And with a sati sampajanya, kind of open to this, then it, what I find is this sense of dispassion, which is a cool feeling. It's very clear, very cool, very pleasant to be dispassionate. It's not like a dispassion through dullness or just through kind of, you know, a kind of cynicism, an intellectual cynicism. It's a feeling of just a feeling of non-aversion, but not no longer seeing the human body in such the standard way of either, you know, being seeing it only as very attractive and beautiful, or seeing it as ugly and foul. But being able to just relate to this human body, the body that we call our own, or somebody else's, or a corpse, just seeing it in terms of satipanya, satisampachanya, is the experience of dispassion. Well, say lust is a lack of discrimination, isn't it? It's the experience of like lust, sexual lust is a strong passion that takes you over and you lose your discriminative abilities. The more you absorb into it, the more less discriminatory you get. Where the critical mind, like and it's interesting, the critical people, the people that are kind of dosa-jarit types, they like the super practices usually. They like, or they like very methodic meditations, you know. You do this and then you do that, and then kind of very, you know, intellectually well presented, stage one, stage two, nicely, in a nice little outline, and then to see the body as foul and disgusting is where, if you're critical, it's easy to see it that way. Or say Raga jarit, a kind of gamaraga, lustful, greedy type person. They like metta meditation the best. You teach metta and they, you know. Because metta, you're not critical, is it? Metta is you're not being critical about anything. So these are upayas to get perspective. If one is a lustful type, then the supa practices can be very balancing, can be very skillfully used for developing a more discriminative, more aware of the unpleasantness or the non-beautiful. And then the dosajarit, the averse types, the metta, being able to accept what you don't like without indulging in being critical and rejecting and averse to it. So metta meditation then is really, it's willing, it can be done in a kind of stylized way that we have, but basically it is satisampachanya. Satisampachanya is not, it accepts, it includes. Metta is one of those inclusive. Is very intuitive rather than conceptual. So we're not when you try to conceive metta as love, a kind of liking or loving something in a term of liking it makes it impossible. To sustain metta when you get to things you can't stand or people you hate and things like that, it's really hard to come to terms with it on a conceptual level, isn't it? Like, love your enemies, or to love people you hate, who you can't stand, is on the conceptual level is an impossible dilemma. But in terms of satisampachanya, it's accepting. It's because it includes everything you hate. And like and dislike. So then metta isn't analytical, it's not dwelling on why you hate somebody. And it's not trying to figure out why I hate this person. But it includes the whole thing, why the feeling, the person, myself, all in the same moment. So it's embracing the point that includes non-critical. You aren't trying to figure out anything, but just open and accept. Patient. With it being patient. So with food, for instance, we can see that because we eat the Tudanga tradition. They are eating from alms bowls, and I never can convince myself I'm eating one meal a day anymore. because of this breakfast. But whatever, how many meals a day you eat, the idea is limitation, not because of, there's anything wrong with enjoying a meal. It's not like food is dangerous and you've got to, any kind of pleasure you receive from eating will bind you to rebirth again in the samsara vata. That's another view and opinion, but recognize that it's the simplicity of the life that we have. It's simplifying everything. This this is why I like this way. Then the pleasure, and it's notice the attitude towards food about how you know, just the greed or the aversion or the guilt about eating or enjoying food, good food or whatever. Include it all, you know. Both, it's not, there's no attitude that you have to have, you know, that you toward it, but an attitude of sati sampajanya. So not making eating into any hassle. You know, like Lungpa Cha was, when I'd go on these fasts and all that, he'd say, you know, and he'd point out, I was always making a hassle out of my food. You know, I couldn't just eat. I had to, there was always, I was making it more difficult than it need be. And then the guilt that comes up if you eat too much, or you find yourself, you know, you find yourself trying to get the good bits. It bring up this kind of, in me, I remember, you know, trying to, you know, get the good pieces for myself, and then feeling guilty about that. So, you know, there's a greed that really, you know, wants the good, the tasty bits, and then feels guilty about it. It gets complicated. I couldn't be just greedy and shameless. I also had to deal with a strong sense of guilt around it, and not wanting people to, hoping nobody'd notice. If I was being greedy, I was hoping nobody would see. I keep it a secret. Because I didn't want to look greedy. I wanted to look like I wasn't greedy. And so I remember with Lungpa Jan, and I was trying to be a vegetarian then, really strict. Lungpa Jan and Wat Bung Kaluang, seventh Vasa, and he let me do this, so I was helping pass out the food too. And so at the monastery, they had certain kinds of dishes that didn't have any fish sauce in them or any kind of meat or fish. But as most of you know, in Thailand, most of the food has fish sauce in it or some kind of animal mixtures into it. So it's really hard. It was difficult because I had very little choice, and then people would always have to make special things for me. Or it had to be special, and to be Ajahn Sumedho's, or it wasn't Ajahn then, but Pat Sumedho's food, and then the rest. So that was hard to deal with, you know, to be a foreigner, a Prat Phrang, and then have special diet and special privileges and. That was hard for me to impose on the group. But then the passing out the food, I get very possessive. Like the vegetable dishes they did have, I felt I had a right to have a lot of it because the other monks were eating all the fish and chicken and things like that. So I find myself, when I was passing out, aiming for the vegetarian dishes first, so I could pass them out according to to my own needs. And I was really brought up a really kind of childish tendency in me. And then one time, one monk, he he saw me doing this, he grabbed the vegetarian dish first and only gave me a little spoonful. Then I was so angry when I saw that. I took this fermented fish sauce, this bladak, kind of this very kind of strong stuff. And when I went by his bowl, I splattered it all over his food. Fortunately, we are forbidden to hit each other. This is an absolute necessity for men, and they have rules of non-physical violence. So I was trying to live up to an ideal of vegetarian purity, and yet in the process, you know, having these really violent feelings and towards other monks, you know, what's this about? You know, wanting to, you know, this is a vindictive act, wasn't it? A violent act to splatter all that strong chili sauce with a rotten fish in it over some monk's food. It was a violent act. In order to keep me in the sense of I'm a pure vegetarian. And so I began to question whether I wanted to make food into such a big deal for my life. You know, really, was I wanting to live my life as a vegetarian, or what? Was that the main focus that I was aiming at? So then just contemplating this, I just began to see the suffering I created around my idealism. So it's then in terms of, you know, I noticed like Lungpa Cha certainly enjoyed his food, and he had a joyful presence. And so it wasn't like, you know, an ascetic trip where you know, eating nettle soup and rejecting the good bits. That's the other extreme. So sati sampajanya, then it includes, and that's the kind of attitude of a samana, rather than the ascetic, which is sensual temptations, the sensual world, sensual pleasures are bad and dangerous, and you've got to fight against them and resist them at all costs in order to become pure. Because your purity is, once you get rid of sexual desire, greed for food, all these other kind of greedy, unpleasant sense things, you know, coarse, gross things, and you don't have any more bad thoughts, and you don't have any more anger, greed, hatred, and delusion in your mind, you're absolutely sterilized from any of those things. And like eradicated, totally wiped out, like these toilet cleansers that you pour down that kill every germ in sight, then you're pure. And then, you know, you manage to kill everything, including yourself. So is that the aim? You know, that's taking asceticism to the attakilamatanu yok position of annihilation. Or the Gama Sukhalikana Yoka one, where you just, you know, pleasure, drink, eat, and be merry. Or tomorrow you may die, you know, just enjoy life. Life is a banquet. And most of the suckers are starving to death. The movie back in the 50s. Auntie Mame was called. Life is a banquet, and all the suckers are starving to death. And so Auntie Mame managed to, you know, really enjoy to the hilt, in the movie anyway. So she's a kind of icon, a kind of, you know, not a real woman, but an icon of just, you know, intelligent beauty, and one who just lived life to the hilt and enjoyed everything. Now that's a very attractive idol, isn't it? To see this, just life is meant to be full of pleasure and happiness and love. So that grasping that, you know, is the Gama Sukhalikana Yoka. Then in the Samana is awakening to these. It includes both. Not like taking sides. Not that Auntie Mame and life is a banquet is we're rejecting that. Or think, you know, condemning it, or the extreme ascetic, the life-denying annihilator. But we can see that these are conditions that we create in our minds. You know, like wanting always life to be at its best. You know, just a party, a banquet, one pleasure after another. Just assuming that is where it's at. Or thinking that life is, that if you have any pleasure or enjoyment in it, it's wrong and bad and lesser and dangerous. Those are conditions we create. But the samana, life is like this right now, it's like this. So it's opening to what we tend to not notice when we're seeking those two extremes as our goal. So life is like this. It's kind of say it's a banquet all the time, is it? Breath going in. Wouldn't describe it as a banquet. Or the sound of silence is, you know, life at its best, where it's just one laugh after another. Just like this. I mean, most of our experience is neither one extreme or the other. It's like this, isn't it? Most of your one life that you live is not the peak moments, either in their height or their depth, but it's neither nor, with that which we don't notice if we're primed for the extremities. I find in terms of like beauty, for example, the coming from sati sampajanya, rather than from personal attachments. And so like beautiful objects, beautiful things, beautiful people, or whatever, then coming from personal habits, it is dangerous because of the desire to possess them, isn't it? To have them for yourself or be attracted and get kind of overwhelmed by the desires that arise through seeing beauty through ignorance. And then beauty from the satisampajanya, then you can be aware of that, of the beauty as beauty. And then you also include one's own tendencies to want to own it or take it or touch it or fear it. You know, it includes that. But when you're letting go of that, then beauty itself is joy. We live on a planet that is quite beautiful. You know, nature, in a wise, is quite beautiful to the eye. So seen from the satisampajanya, then I experience joy from that. For seeing from the personal habits, then it can get complicated. I'll complicate it, no doubt, with wanting, not wanting, guilt, or just not even noticing. You know, if you get too involved with your own, what's in your head, you don't even notice after a while anything outside. You can be in the most beautiful place in the world and not see it, not notice it. So then beauty, say, as experience or sense pleasure, then is seen as something for what it is. It is pleasurable. Good food does taste good. Tasting good, delicious flavor is like this. It's thoroughly enjoyable. You know, it's that's the way it is. And then you come to, I shouldn't. Then you're adding more to it. But from satisampajanya, then it is what it is. So things become really, it's experienced then the flow of life from this center point, from the still point that includes, rather than from the point that excludes, the extremity, where we want only the beautiful and the good tastes, and the life is a banquet, and just have one banquet after another. That's an extremity that, when we can't sustain that illusion, we get depressed. We go to the opposite, wanting to kill ourselves or annihilate ourselves in some way. So it's like this weather we've been having is it's the kind of what people think England is all the time. Cold, wet, damp, drizzly, grey. So this is the worldwide perception of England. So then, but so then I decided I decided to open the Satisampajanya to these conditions. So it is what it is, you know, but it's, I'm not creating an aversion onto it. You know, it's all right. It's nothing. And it isn't like this very often. I've lived in this country 24 years. Some of the most beautiful weather I've ever experienced has been here in this country. The perfect days of, they're so beautiful, the greenness and the beautiful flowers and hills and things like this. So, you know, but those can be easily dismissed. And remembering the perception of that England is like this is as a constant factor. So the Satisampajanya includes the cold, wet, grey, drizzly weather. There's no aversion created in it. In fact, I like it in a way because I don't feel compelled to go out in it. I can sit in my kuti and kind of keep warm. I quite enjoy feeling I don't have to go out anywhere, because the weather's so good, I can just stay in my room. Which I quite like, you know, quite nice feeling to not, because when the weather gets really good, I always feel I should be out. Get this guy. Desire to go out into it. I mean, these are just ways of just noticing, you know, even within the what is can be physically unpleasant, like cold, dampness, and that, and things like this that we find maybe unpleasant as sensory experiences. The suffering really is from the aversion. You know, I don't like this, I don't want life to be like this. I want to be where there's blue skies and sunshine all the time. So, like neutrality, that they can say sweeping, body sweeping practice. You know, this paying attention to neutral sensation I found very helpful to me because it was so easily ignored. You know, it completely ignored. When I first started doing it years ago, because I never paid attention to neutral sensation, I found it difficult to find, even though it's quite obvious. Because my experience of sensation was always through extremity, as either pleasure or pain. But then noticing just the how the robe touches the skin, or just the one hand touching the other, or the tongue in the mouth, the tongue touching the palate or the teeth, or the upper lip resting on the lower lip, or investigating little details of sensation that are there when you open to them, isn't it? They're there, but you don't notice them, unless you determine it. Because if your lips are painful, you notice. If you're getting a lot of pleasure from your lips, then you don't. But when there's neither pleasure nor pain, there's still sensation, isn't there? It's neutral. And so you're allowing neutrality to be conscious. You see, this is like consciousness is a mirror where it reflects. So a mirror reflects, it doesn't reflect just the beautiful or the ugly. You really look into the mirror, it's reflecting whatever, the space, the neutral, everything that is in front of it. But if you you can only notice the outstanding ones, either the really, the extremities of beauty or ugliness. But to be awakened, to awaken to the way it is, then you're not looking at the obvious, but recognizing the subtlety behind the beauty and the ugliness, the extremities. So like with sound of silence, isn't it? It's like a subtlety behind everything that you awaken to, because you don't notice it usually if you're seeking the extremities. When you're seeking happiness and trying to get away from pain and misery, when you're caught in that, always trying to get something or hold on to happiness, or tranquility, isn't it? We want tranquility. We want samatha and jhanas and get tranquil, and so that because we like tranquility, and then we don't want confusion or chaos or cacophony or abrasive sensory experiences or human contacts. We don't want that, so we sit, close our eyes. Don't bother me. Give off the signs, coming to the temple and sit down, don't bother me attitude, and leave me alone, and I'm going to get my meditation, my samadhi. So then that can be the very basis for our practice, getting my samadhi. So I can feel good, because I want that. So that leads to an extremity again, wanting, trying to always be after the ideal of something, of refined conscious experience. Then there's the others that say, you don't need to do that. You just, daily life is good enough. Just in the marketplace practice, that's where it's really at. You're not doing anything extreme like sitting, closing your eyes, but you're just, living life as an ordinary person and being mindful of everything. And that also can be another ideal that we attach to these are ideals, aren't they? Positions that we might take. So they're the kind of true but not right, right but not true predicament that we make with our dualistic mind. Not that they're wrong, either one. You know, that one's wrong and one's right. Or one's more right than the other. Well, the animal farm, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. Yeah. You can't help. In the conditioned realm, just think like that, isn't it? In terms of, we all think we're, human beings are all equal, don't we? Ideally. All human beings are equal. But then in the practicalities of life, some are more equal than others. You know, if I find the affluent Western world willing to give up very much for the sake of equality in the third world, do we? I mean, they really resist. So the immigrants are coming into the country. They might lower the standard of living. We'd be more equal then. So reflect on a like monastic form is a it's a convention, and so it has you know its aim is to it's connected to the world, and so it's through its alms mendicancy we need the society, we need the world around, we need the lay community for our survival. They're apart, you know, it's not an attack or a rejection of lay life. And so that need then, and then our life does, if we're living in a, you know, trying to live in the right way, then the lay community, brings out their good qualities, generosity and gratitude, things like this. So then, but we also can, the move towards silence is encouraged, towards meditation, reflection. So we combine both the kind of samatha vipassana, the life of solitude with the worldly life. You know, it's not to be, you know, to reject one and hold on to the other as the ideal, but to recognize this is the way it is. Like this, the world that we live in, the society that we live in, we're not rejecting it or turning against it or away from it, but including it. And so then we can include in the silence and the solitude. So viveka then is a like Gaya viveka, Jiti viveka, Ubati viveka. There's three kind of vivekas. Gaya viveka is like physical solitude. Jiti viveka, mental. Ubati viveka is intuitive. So tomorrow is the last day before the observance. So there'll be monks, Ajahn Menindo, and the Hara monks are coming today, and then we'll have an influx. 24th, the bhikkhus will have their Samaki Patimokkha, which is it's an upasaka today, but also the monks from Chithurst and Switzerland, Italy, Annam, all will have a Samaki Patimokkha is the ideal of unity. It's a way of